Yeah.
I mean, like, messed up, like, won't demo? It looks okay.
Yeah, I guess it's fine.
You can mention that. I don't know.
All right, we're going to get started once again.
I need a microphone. Is this my microphone? Yes, it is. I just got to...
Put that. Or put it in the pocket. What are you doing?
We make it a PPS, then it'll start inside the show.
You probably want to put that in the pocket so it doesn't bang against the
back. Never mind, it's already running.
Okay. Just bring it up.
I would think Marcus can take off pretty quick.
Alt F function at front.
Function at 5. I should get there. Okay.
All right, so coming up next, we have yet another standardization proposal with associated source code, which perhaps may inspire yet another bout of extremely spirited debate. Yes, it is. So... So, if we could take our seats, or step outside if you're still locked in the previous spirited debate. I would like to introduce John Radcliffe, who's been working on some physics stuff for the past while, and he's going to tell you all about it. Thank you, John.
All right. Everybody hear me okay? So a lot of you probably already know me. I've been in the game industry for almost as long as Bill Budge, who's here. My last game was PlanetSide, which was a massively multiplayer first-person shooter. We used a licensed piece of physics middleware in there called Karma. So I come from the game industry background of actually doing engine development, tools development, and I'm now working for Agia. Open Dynamics Framework, it sounds a little like ODE. I wasn't outright copying them, but it is related. It's doing similar things. So a lot of people are familiar with ODE. Russell, I can't remember his last name, but he worked at Math Engine, left, and released a fully functioning physics engine open source to the development community, and a lot of people have had fun messing around with it. ODF is an open source effort to try to provide tools to facilitate getting physics into games. It also has ancillary benefit for people doing research projects and things like that. So what it is, it's a wrapper layer. It was back to the discussion Casey had today, and I was a little relieved when I asked people to raise their hands, and they all said the first thing they do is write wrapper layers, because that's the first thing I did. Is I wrote wrapper layers for about four different pieces of physics middleware and learned the commonality, the things that they all do the same. And at one point in February, I actually had an implementation that loaded four separate physics engines and ran physics simulations on all four simultaneously in split screen. And I thought that was very intellectually cool, but I did not pursue it because there were stability issues and it was just a lot of development effort. I've been using the Novadex SDK, is the current implementation that I have a fully implemented wrapper for, and I have DLLs for all of the other physics middleware that is free for non-commercial use. Another thing that I'm basically, the only thing I'm really trying to get people to agree on here is for us to agree on what's the data associated with physics. We can see some of the chaos that happened with Collada, all these efforts that have been made for 3D graphics that have been tried and failed. I'm hoping that we can prevent that by coming in early on. There is no standard for physics describing the properties of a physical scene. It just doesn't exist. So I'm going to put a straw man out there. I'm making an open source website. If you guys want to collaborate, great. If you just want to keep rolling your own the way you have been, that's fine too. But if you would like to work on this, that would be fantastic. We are working on plug-in components for 3D Studio Max, Maya, Softimage, the major DCC tools. We have, I try to be file format agnostic. So when I say agree upon a data model, I am not talking about a file format. That's semantics. I don't care if you put it in XML, binary, it's really beside the point. The common thing is what is the data? How does one describe a rigid body or a constraint or a friction model? Can we agree on that? And I've looked at enough of the pieces of physics middleware that people are sort of cramming into their games, and there is a common pattern there, right? So I think we can accomplish that. I also have an application called Rocket, which I'll be demoing. ODF is not a physics engine, so that's why I don't want it to be confused with ODE. It is a wrapper and a set of tools on top of a physics engine. It's not done. I've been working on this since January, and I said for a very long time it's going to be open source, and I just arbitrarily decided that today it's open source. So it doesn't mean it's done, but when I go back to work on Monday and I check in my source code, it will be live immediately then and there. So every day I do check-ins, and whether anybody cares, we'll find out, but it is going to be an open source effort and an ongoing project. And it's not a game engine. It has game engine-like properties because it has to emulate the things you're going to try to do and show by example, but it's not meant trying to be that. You get it. A lot of people don't know this, but Perforce actually is free for open source projects. They don't give you that automatically. You have to negotiate a license with them, but we did that. So the way you get the source code is two ways. One, you download a big-ass binary that has a ton of sample data, and you install it. And at that point, you should be able to load it into VC6 or VC.NET and build it. But if you want to get updates after that, you can sync to a Perforce repository, which anybody can sync to, anonymous. And if you want to be a contributor, if you're a tools programmer or you want to assign one of your tools programmers to work with us on this, I'll give you write access, and you can start doing check-ins and improvements on that. I also have a message forum because I don't want this to be a read-only effort. I don't want people coming, taking away, and not contributing back to the cause. And I see that a lot with like the source forges of the world. A lot of people go there and download stuff, but they rarely contribute back to the effort. So I want this to be collaborative. So when I talked to Jonathan Blow about this, he's like, who's you want to make standards, who's involved? These are four engineers who are actually being paid money to work on this. And I've tried to solicit feedback from the development community. I've posted messages on algorithms and sent private emails to a lot of the people who've spoken here, and they've given me fantastic feedback. These are some of the guys that I've bugged, and they've given me some feedback, and I like to think that what you're seeing today reflects a lot of their input. Why Aegea? Aegea is a startup company I went to work for. Without an NDA, I'm not supposedly allowed to tell you what we do, but to be quite honest, any of you who are here, we'd be happy to talk to under NDA. Not under NDA, we are selling a consumer product. We are not selling to developers. My mandate is to make physics be a commodity. Right now, people perceive physics as something very daunting that only you, your most advanced J. Stelly of the world, can work on. I want physics to be something that somebody who programs in C# can go and make really cool-looking things. So I want it to be a commodity. I want it to be something researchers, I want it to be something that everybody who's writing a game who wants to have physical properties in it, it doesn't find that experience intimidating. Now, that's not so interesting to you, but impacting that are lack of standardization and tools, and hopefully this effort will address that. You can read this offline, but I have a similar what Jay was describing. Everything, every piece of code I've written is in a DLL plugin approach, and the intent was that you can use any one of these DLLs as itself, by itself, and take advantage of the functionality that's there, so you could incorporate it in your own tools chain or your existing pipelines. You might not like everything that's in there. Again, I think I've touched on this already, is just that standards are good if people can collaborate and agree on it. And then again, more about standards. I'm going through these slides really fast because I wanted to let people read them on their own time and get some more information. So I originally felt that working with inside of we had a debate at whether or not we should be writing a standalone tool. for physics. And as at GDC, I talked to a lot of people, and the feedback I got over and over again is, we don't want yet another tool. We do everything in Max, or we do everything in Maya. We want it to work that way. So it would have been kind of nice to just write our own tool, because then we'd have a single tool. But we've gone instead to try to take that feedback to heart, and we're taking this approach. We're originally starting with 3D Studio Max. Hey, it's easier, but most importantly, 3D Studio Max already understands physics. There's already a way to describe physics in the context of Max, so we're leveraging against that, but we fully intend to. We've also, I think I mentioned on a previous slide, we've hired Stan Milax, which a lot of people know. In fact, I posted a message on algorithms trying to find out if he was dead or not. He's not dead. He was taking care of his newborn baby, and he's now back to work, and he's writing a 3D Studio Max plugin right now. I think most of you guys know there's physics authoring. We artists know how to author texture maps, meshes, animations, but you go and you tell an author to make a rag doll or a convex hull, and their eyes are going to glaze over. So there is a whole authoring aspect that comes to physics, and I don't want that to be a barrier. I don't want you to go to a developer and go, oh, by the way, you have to have a whole new authoring pipeline. That's going to be different the way you do everything else. So we're trying to help facilitate that and make that process as automated as possible. We have longer-term goals. These aren't going to happen overnight, but it is my view. Right now, for example, you can do some physics-type stuff in 3D Studio Max. When you want to test that your ragdoll worked, you actually go off and launch another application. Well, that's ridiculous. You should just be able to run your ragdoll right inside of Max. We would like to see physics deeply integrated at the deepest levels of all the major DCC tools, that it's part of your animation pipeline. And we heard a lot of that kind of stuff coming from the natural motion people the other day and saw some of the benefits of that deep integration. I have this holy grail thing that may not ever happen, but my holy grail thing is that I can be tuning or tweaking a vehicle in my authoring tool, click a button, and be driving it around my game level. Then click a button and I'm tweaking the suspension. And I'm doing that directly in my authoring environment. It may never happen, but it would be very cool. Create Dynamics DLL, it only really kind of exists as a concept. The code that's there does work, but it's just some experimental stuff. We're going to rip this out. What Create Dynamics DLL is conceptually, you hand it graphics assets, and then you say, use these rules, and out the other end, it will spit out a dynamics description. So in its most basic form, if you take a character, a mesh deformed skeletal character, and you hand it to Create Dynamics DLL, out the other end is, you get a default ragdoll. Is that ragdoll made of boxes, capsules, hulls? That's where the rules come in. This could be run as a console application. It could be run inside 3D Studio Max. It could be run in any variety of context. It's one of the things we want to do is generate aggregate convex hulls, which is some area that Stan has done research-wise. So I've made some demos that show this conceptually. They do work, but the code is going to have to get rewritten. So this shows an example of a piece of artwork I took from a game a friend of mine is working on. I was really shocked when I started doing this that I got really decent looking ragdolls using default properties. I was kind of surprised. I thought I would have to do a lot of tweaking, and they look pretty cool. Here's another pictures of a few of the automatic ragdolls that came out. That's the bug I was talking about the other day. And then this was something that came out of it. One day I was messing around with it, and I turned off gravity, and all of a sudden I had a monster floating in space. And I thought that was really cool. And then we still were playing with some other properties, and we got the effect of claymation. And I've since heard that there's a commercial product that actually does this. I haven't seen it. I think it's called Motion Builder. But at any rate, it to me, I think it shows some of the ideas. From my perspective, I was messing with this, and if you handed me 3D Studio Max and asked me to pose a character in a karate move, I couldn't do it if my life depended on it. But with this kind of interactivity, I could pose the character in all kinds of interesting ways with no real experience. I'm going to show a quick demo of that running here. All right, how do I do this, dude? Thank you. Is that going to come up? All right, so this is the application that uses all those DLL components. And where is Bishan? So there he is. And I'm going to grab hold of him. And one of the things I'll do here is drag using a constraint. And I can sort of pose him and do all kinds of crazy things with him. And it's really kind of fun to play with. But you can see whenever you tug on anything, it's going to ripple those effects through the whole chain. And then this is the automatically generated physical. So I told it fit boxes, and it just automatically fit these boxes. Now you can see it's overdescribed. It actually has a rigid body for every single finger. The rule-based approach is going to be based on skeletal names, where you can say, hey, anything that has the string finger in it, collapse that into the parent bone. So that's where we're heading with this. It doesn't actually do all that right now. Another demo of a rag doll. This is something that, unfortunately, somehow or another, the texture is missing. But this is a demo to show a kinematic object. So that horse is running on a piece of art, animated artwork that an artist made. Here's the auto-generated physics model. So he's just going where he's told. But that tail on the horse is completely dynamic, and all the waving and action. So he's physically part of the world. Everything has to react to him. And you press a key, and boom, he's fully dynamic, and I can grab him and pick him up and throw him around. Here's a demo I liked. This is a demo I used to like to run until the Abu Ghraib prison scandal, and then it took all the fun away as I built stacks and stacks of corpses. So the idea of basically just button-click ragdolls, I think that is a powerful concept and something worth putting in the hands of developers. All right, now go back here to F5. Great. So what I'm trying to do, I'm trying to bite off only what I can chew here, which is what I'm calling rigid body physics 1.0, the stuff that's really easy to agree on, which is what is a rigid body, what is a geometry, what is a constraint, and limit it to that. When we talk about the real issues that a lot of the higher end games are going to be dealing with, it goes far beyond that, and you've got ray cast vehicles, custom pulley joints, fluid simulation, clothing, a lot of things. And that's out of scope for what I'm trying to do here initially. Here I've got a list of the physics middleware vendors. Again, I want to get back to this theme that physics used to be this very high-end thing, and Havok still charges a pretty penny for their license. But it's becoming more and more of a commodity all the time, and more people are making physics engines available completely free for non-commercial use. And this lists some of them. The Novadex SDK is the one I've been using. It's wicked, wicked fast, and again, free for non-commercial use and not much more for commercial use. The couple of slides here were to show just what you guys probably already know is, if you want to experiment or play around with physics, you know, you haven't made that commitment yet, but you want to explore it, every single API is completely different. And what you're going to do is you're going to write a wrapper layer. I'm providing a wrapper layer I call Open Physics. It violates every single precept that Casey presented earlier today. In fact, his example of how you do something horrifically wrong was this. This is not something I am proposing anyone actually use in a real game. If you want to do hardcore physics in your game, you know, come talk to us. Go talk to Havok. Do it the right way. This is for people who want to prototype, experiment, get their feet wet. And it's a wrapper layer. It's what you would have written yourself if you wrote your own wrapper layer. It's open source. If you think I made bad decisions, tell me. We'll change it. Okay, this is meant to be collaborative. So I have a pure virtual interface that provides this. And this actually is the interface that every single demo, and I think a lot of you may have seen the Rocket demos already, every single demo in there talks through this interface, and that's pretty complete with the exception of some debugging routines that do some debug visualization. It's a fake, I have a set state, get state pattern, so instead of 50 calls, the one that sets inertia tensor, one sets gravity, and one sets this, I just have a single set get pattern with an enumerated type. But it's, you can see it'd be very, very easy to, if you wanted to just play around with some stuff, you could use that API. These opaque data types, gets back to the issue of transparency. Under the hood, when you say create a rigid body, Havoc's going to do it one way, somebody else is going to do it another way. I use an opaque handle, which is really just a void pointer, to sort of carry that along. So we just carry that along, and the individual piece of middleware handles it. The big thing, so whether you use the API or not, I don't really care, but if we could all agree on what the data is, that's really what I want to accomplish. So I have what I'm hoping we can get people to agree on, and I have some opinion about the value. But here's a really sexy UML diagram of how I've organized the data, and this is certainly open for debate, and I'd be happy to engage people in discussion on the forums. But at the top level, I have a thing I call a physics container, and that would be analogous to a single, say, scene, in your game. It could be a part of a scene, right? But it's just a scene. And I have, within that context, I have what are static data assets. Static data assets are geometries, triangle mesh data, that sort of thing. And then ultimately, you instance those things. You instance rigid bodies and joints and other features. And that's what a physics model is. So when I go and I click a button and create that deer, that's a single physics model. And I can instance that deer. And it can be hierarchical. So I can have instances of instances of instances. And I don't know if anyone has seen the catapult demo in the Rocket demos, and I'll try to show it quickly later, but there's a case where I had a kid was trying to do a catapult, and he had a description of a ragdoll, and he had a description of his catapult, and he's like, well, I want to launch the ragdoll at the thing, so he created instances within instances and then instanced them. So this in C++ is what the data items are for a rigid body. There is absolutely open for debate whether or not that's the appropriate way to represent an inertia tensor, whether or not the solver count really belongs in here or not. Every single data type in every property has a user settings field. And a user settings field means stuff that isn't in this data structure. It's a way for you to add additional data, user params, as you will. You'll notice that I just use floats. That's because I don't want to impress my vector and quaternion and matrix classes on everybody else. So, as far as I'm concerned, an array of three floats is pretty standard. These are bit flags, and you guys can look at this. These are the shape types it represents, box, sphere, plane, capsule, convex. I since realized I should have cylinder on there. If anybody thinks there should be other shape types, let me know. It does support compound shapes. The joint specification is a programmable 6-degree of freedom joint. So you'll look at a lot of physics APIs, and they'll have create me a hinge, or create me a ball and socket, or create me a prismatic, and they have separate API calls, separate data structures, and in the end, you can, at least in that context, you can think of all of your constraints as limits on the 6 basic degrees of freedom, angular and linear. So in my data definition, that's how you describe a constraint. And then when it's actually instanced on a particular vendor, it maps that to whatever the closest approximate is. So I have a reflective object model that takes those C++ header files and maps it exactly one-to-one to an XML. Think of this as an API. It's not per se a file format. It's just a way for us to express that data in an ASCII representation. Back to the topic of floating point versus ASCII representation. I don't show it here, but in my semantic, any numeric value, can express the IEEE floating point version. So you actually see out to however many decimal points you care to the ASCII version, and then after that is a hex version that you can't easily read, but at least it maintains the full precision. Another feature of this system is the ability to save scene state. It'll take the entire state of a physical simulation and write it out to disk, and you can bring it back in. It's proven extremely useful for debugging. This particular physics engine is already being used for the next generation, Unreal Engine 3, and on a day-in, day-out basis, the programmer on that will send me core dumps. So I don't have the source code to Unreal Engine 3. I don't have any of his stuff. He just takes a core dump of his simulation, sends it to me, and we debug the problem he might be experiencing. Down the road, we'd like to explore full scene capture playback, which is a presentation, the next one after mine. It's not a feature I have in there right now. Here's the description for how we describe physical materials. So physics file formats, as I said, there aren't any. There actually is one from Havok, but like everything with Havok, it's utterly proprietary. I've never seen Havok's API. I've never seen their file format. It's their right. It's their intellectual property. They're going to keep that private. So I would love to. I don't want to create new formats if formats exist. There is an old format called CAT. If anybody ever messed with a thing called CAT, it came with Unreal Tournament for creating ragdolls. It's an XML format. It's kind of a pigeon description. It lacks everything you need. But my intent is to be file format agnostic and read in and out any format. So that means if you guys have some format you use in-house, I will happily write a translator or work with you to write a translator for that. Collada, I see no reason not to work with the Collada people if there's physics data in the context of the scene graph in the DCC tool. Why not migrate that? So one of the cool things about this application, which we've now rebranded ODF Rocket. One of the cool things about this application, and one thing I want to make clear, is this version that we have shipped, it runs on top of Novadex. It'll also run on top of ODE, and if you write a plug-in, it'll run on top of anyone's physics middleware. Physics scripting is, I want to explain how limited this is. It is just a way, I mean, everybody has consoles, and there are a lot of people have consoles where they can bring down a console and type in a command and execute something. So all I've done is the same thing. You can bring down a console, you can type a command, and you can basically exercise that API I brought up earlier with a physics command. And it works off the concept of default properties. So it has presumed defaults, and if, like, you set the default size for an object, and then you go and create 50 objects, they're all in the current default size. So this proved really powerful. Now, that is the extent of what Piskel is supposed to be, just a way to exercise the API. It's not a scripting language in the conventional sense. There's no loop variables or anything like that. So it's designed to be extended by a general purpose scripting language. In our examples, we use Lua because it's reasonably lightweight and a lot of people have been messing with it. And we had a lot of fun watching some of the things people were able to write. So that is the entire Piskel script to run the demo, which if I had a little more time, I'd alt-tab and show you. But the first command resets the scene. The next one creates a plane, a ground plane, and says, hey, it's static, so don't make the plane fall through the world. Creates a sphere, and then wall is actually a macro, which creates a series of boxes, so wide, so high, and so deep. So that little scenario right there creates kind of a fun little physics demo. I handed this off to some research students. Novadex actually works with ETH, which apparently is like the MIT of Switzerland or something, of Zurich. But they have some really wicked smart guys there, and they assigned one of their guys to mess with Piskel. And he went off and worked for a few days. He never called me or asked for new features, and I didn't expect much. And what I got from him is in the lower right-hand corner, which is a completely physically modeled tank, which if I have time, I'm going to go alt-tab over and run the demo. It's truly, truly an insane thing. And when I was working on PlanetSide, my game designer came to me and said, hey, we would like the tank treads to actually go over the rocks. And I'm like, are you insane? And told him, no way. And so I was really surprised. A lot of people have seen the other demo with the catapults. That trebuchet is physically correct. When the weight drops, the ball is released because a constraint breaks because the torque exceeds a certain value. So those are pretty fun demos. My hope would be that this would become powerful enough that research students could do prototyping. I mean, my thought is, why should you have to learn an entire API and become an expert physics programmer just because you want to do some basic simulation? So this may not be so relevant to everyone here who's a lot more advanced, but I think it does work towards making physics be more of a commodity item. And at the end of the day, we get more people who come into the industry who've already experimented with this stuff and played with it. And I look at the hassle that kids go through who want to use ODE or want to use something to write their little student projects, and it's just painful. So I would like to see someone write an evolutionary robot that actually learns how to walk in like Lewis script. I just think that would be really cool. The lower right-hand corner is a demo script I wrote that does a Fermi spiral of dominoes, and they all correctly in the center, it comes back around. And that's like, you know, no, a few lines of Lua script to do that. And there's one of the DLL components is a mesh importer, and it abstracts the idea. My mesh importer is just to get geometry for the purposes of collision detection, and it will support other file formats. And we have a drop and drag philosophy for 3D Studio Max and Maya that you should be able to get your data out and in and test it right away. So my milestones, my first one was met today. Everything is open source. We're launching a website, physicstools.org, where you can go and download all this stuff. And please, engage me and let me know what you're wanting to use it for if you're interested in helping collaborate. We have a 3D Studio Max exporter and sample files. On the 15th, I want to do a new release where Create Dynamics DLL has a lot more features and is more a usable tool for you guys. And then at GDC, I'd like to more or less be done with this and be able to move on and work on some kind of more interesting things. I think I'm out of time. I'd like to run a couple of demos, if that's okay. All right. So, let me do this. And if I had a little more time, I'd actually edit some of the scripts, because it's kind of fun. But, so this is a little Lua script that generates a Jenga stack, and of course you change one line of code in your Lua script, and now you have a very, very large Jenga stack. This one was kind of interesting. This is a really, really simple script. If I hit the letter B, this is the physical simulation. I just wrote a doubly nested for and x loop that created some boxes and connected them with some joints. And the only thing that's kind of fancy is I wrote an algorithm that takes a collection of rigid bodies and automatically generates a weighted deformed mesh from it. So if I bring this up in wireframe here, I just found the four nearest bones and and that's automatic. So when I run that algorithm, I ran it on a character, and he looked like he was in a body bag. It algorithmically generated a body bag, and I don't have that demo, but it's really kind of funny to look at. Every single thing, if you've ever looked at this, absolutely everything in here is data-driven. There's no code to speak of. These are just little Lua scripts or whatever. And what's going on here? Did it crash or something? It never crashes. What's going on? Well, I hate to have the demo cut short here, but... applications. What's all this pornography clogging things up? Yeah. Brian, you gotta erase your history every now and then. All right, well, I'd like to show some more demos, but it's interrupted. So, any questions? Oh. Yeah, but you say end, and it doesn't really...
I'll start Q&A while you...
Sure.
We'll do some more demos.
Sure.
So thanks a lot, John.
So do we have any questions? We'll start with the simplest questions first so John can kind of answer them while trying to wrestle with the machine.
Okay, here I want to show a couple of the more complex scripts that I alluded to. Tread terrain here. Come on, run. So this is, I'm hitting keys, and all this, me hitting the keyboard and all this stuff is all, everything in here is all scripted. This kind of got started when, this is the one thing, the three-line script I showed you. That's the three-line script. And there's, here's your, oh wait, no, that's just showing capsules. Where's the gears and belt? Where's gears? Friction ramp character. This
right,
is.
It's on the right.
Oh, okay. So this is kind of amusing. As your standard ragdoll falls, something's happening with the timing on this notebook. It's running like crazy fast. So that's kind of your standard conventional ragdoll. But I think it's a lot more interesting when you see the. Where's the bug? Horned bug. This ragdoll here. It's just sort of fun seeing ragdoll models that aren't, this thing's practically walking all without me writing any code, so I'm thinking it wouldn't take a very complicated genetic model to make that thing do a lot of compelling stuff. And there's the physics model for it. And, I love this, you gotta have a rubber chicken, you know. And one of the things that shows, I talked about the mesh importer tool is, do you see Funny Santa? There we go. So this is the famous Homer, this is the Homer Simpson Unreal character, and this was just loaded straight in as a PSK file, and that ragdoll just, and I don't know how, I know artists have spent a lot of time making ragdolls in the past, and you can see it's, there's the convex holes it generated for it. Those convex holes are precise enough that you could probably run a cloth simulation and not have too much Z-buffer fighting, and I think that's kind of interesting. It's a high angular velocity. You get some precession effects. And this is the Siege demo. So there's the trebuchet going, and he's got different catapult types. So there's a dude, and there the catapult launches. But if I brought up this Lua script, this is a pretty, I mean, we're talking a 100, 200 line Lua script. I mean, this is something one of your game designers could do. So I think that's pretty cool. I mean, normally you wouldn't think you could write a simulation that complicated in a few lines of script. All right, well, that's the end of the demos. Oh, yeah, let me bring the tank up, except after the last one crashed, where's the tank? There we go. Wait, let me bring the camera around here. There's a bunch of walls for it to knock over. And you can shoot, if this is the right version of the script, you can actually shoot out of the tank, but I don't know how to do it. The tank treads kind of come off kind of easy if you yank on it. Some other features of this tool is capture playback, so you can capture everything. This is this demo here, this is from a friend of mine's game that I was talking about, is everything in the whole game is totally built, and this is actually a tile-based game, so these are actually all tile pieces, and I read the scene graph and automatically generated the collision geometry from that. And if this one will load, oh, here's one that's a little interesting. It's kind of neat scene. So this was an auto-generated physics model, and you know, the thing is actually standing and pretty robust on its own. And, you know, kind of mixing that physics behavior with an animation channel might be kind of interesting. I've got some demos that show height fields. This one is really a wild-looking ragdoll. And lastly, not that one. Your standard soldier. So,
all right, let's do some questions.
All right.
Or comments. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Anyone?
No questions.
Chris had something, but I think he's holding back. If no one has anything else, we're going to have to unleash Chris.
I do have a question. So far, you've been able to demonstrate just the rigid body physics going on. How easy would it be to integrate a controls system into that? If you wanted to integrate like a traditional proportional derivative controller or otherwise, how easy would it be to incorporate it into this environment?
Not easily as it is now. It just wasn't designed for that.
John, I have a question for you. You brought up the slide where you showed the six commercial physics engines and said that you had wrappers for those six inside the rocket, but then later on you said you didn't actually, you hadn't looked at the Havok API. So which engines have you actually written the unified wrapper for open physics with?
ODE, Tokamak, one proprietary Novadex, so those were the four. I mean, I did do one, but it was a proprietary API. It wasn't one that's public at the time. And so what happens is when you get this application and when you get the source code, there's actually source code to build DLL plugins for Tokamak, et cetera, and they're effectively no opt-out. It's like, insert code here. I haven't implemented them, but they are there, and you can switch physics engines on the fly. There's a drop-down in there, and it lists all the physics engines you've compiled. You change it, and you can change in a init file which physics engine it uses at startup.
Could you maybe just talk for a second about what differences did you notice in behavior?
Hey, that was my question.
To be quite honest, I don't want to overstate the effort I did. I did enough to learn and get it working, and then as soon as the other physics engines started crashing, I got very, very impatient, and I found most of the other physics engines were extraordinarily unstable. And if I would run any of these demos you saw here, except for the most simple ones, they would just crash horrifically. And I didn't have the patience to, you know, worry about. Novadex is a very fast, very stable physics engine. I don't work for these guys, but I like their physics engine. Okay, so I'm enthusiastic about that particular engine. Well, so if you want to take the pain to get ODE to run that Siege demo, go for it. I would love for that to happen.
Well, a really valuable thing for physicstools.org or whatever, for you to do would be actually to do a set of tests. If you've got the wrapper, actually do it for Havok and Karma too, because you want to actually get the big boys. And like, actually have a suite of tests and say like, you know, the failure matrix of like who did what at what frame rate, you know, what kind of failures did you see, and maybe even a little MPEG or something you could run would be great, because that
yeah.
So qualitative and quantitative comparison of physics engines is one of the things that's missing.
Right, and I'm all for that, and that's why the project is open source. I have X amount of bandwidth, and I can only do so much. So if by making it open source, if I can get people engaged to do that, what I didn't talk about, this tool has purposes in-house. We use it for regression testing. We actually run all those scripts, regression test, for performance changes, et cetera. So it's designed to do those kinds of things. But my ability to spend engineering resources getting ODE to, you know, do that. We did write an ODE implementation that was fairly complete, but that we didn't maintain it. So we're certainly considering doing that.
You just mentioned you used those tests for regression tests.
Correct.
So you mentioned performance. What else do you check? Because you can't check final positions of things. I mentioned those are too volatile.
Well, actually, yes, we do. I have a whole separate presentation I did for the work. But there's a number of things we test for. We test for memory leaks, performance, does it crash, these obvious things. And I never been one big on this unit test thing, because I always think it's more work to write the unit test than the benefit you get. And then how do you know that your unit test doesn't have bugs in it? But I had this sort of breakthrough where we have these simulations, we run them baseline, and everybody in the company says, that looks great. I'm completely happy to know when that broke, and it is a requirement of our physics engine that it be deterministic, that it was given the same initial starting conditions from one run to the next, it must produce absolutely identical results. And if it does not, that's a bug. So we have, what we do is we run against baseline tests, where after the simulation has run so many frames, we've recorded the complete state, and then we compare that. So if someone does a check-in, and we have levels of deviation, right? So like, for example, if something explodes, if all of a sudden high energy gets injected in the system, that's a frickin' bug. But if a brick wall fell over, and one brick landed, you know, a millimeter over, it's probably not a big deal. So things are flagged based on, we're going to make a web-based system where we can tag criteria and set levels where this is a warning, this is fatal, et cetera. But the most basics are, did it get slower? And we have inspection where we know why it got slower. Did it spend more time in a context solver? Did it spend more time doing, you know, broad phase, narrow phase? So when something is slower, your very first question is, why did it get slower? And we have that access to that data.
Can I assume by your comments that you always have the same compiler and environment? I mean, if a compiler...
Right. The debug build is not deterministic with the release build. That is correct.
But no, but with just across compilers, you might have different optimization of some of the statements.
Yeah.
So how can you expect to get
we
the same
are
results?
We not deterministic on different compilers. What I mean is, given one compile, one build, one executable, it will be deterministic. But if you compile it under Unix, it's required to be deterministic under Unix. It's just that deterministic result might not be identical.
So your regression testing is always on the same platform?
Correct.
And so that doesn't guarantee that it will run on anything else other than the platform you have?
Well, we have a full-time test engineer, and his job is to regression test against any platform that we ship a version of the SDK for. So, yeah, we have to keep different core dumps for different builds, configurations.
All right, so we're going to move on now and do a little bit more about physics. Oh, yes. Thank you, John. So we're not done with physics yet. That was a whole, you know, if I'm going to use physics, what are the sort of mechanical, you know, things I can do to make that easier? There's a whole other set of questions, like what is this going to do to my game, right? What kind of stuff do I need to worry about if I start adopting physics? And so Brian Sharp's going to talk about that, mostly a short talk, which is going to segue again into more discussion. So take it away, Brian.
Yeah. It's going to be a short talk because I'm going to talk really fast because I think I have too many slides. So if I talk even faster than usual, my apologies. So I'm Brian Sharp, and this is my talk, Things to Think About When Using a Physics Engine. First, quickly who I am. I'm an engine programmer. Note that I'm not a lead programmer. I've never been a lead programmer, but I've worked on just about every engine subsystem and for various game companies and hardware companies and stuff like that. And certainly I've worked with plenty of lead programmers and seen a lot of successes and failures there, and so that's what informs this talk. Come on. All right. So this talk is basically about the considerations that you guys as technical leads have to go through when you're considering using and then actually doing development with a physics engine. And obviously there's quite a few, and I've got 20 or 25 minutes, so we're going to kind of go over the top handful that I came up with. I wanted to do this talk as kind of a hypothetical development walkthrough and just pick a single system. And physics seems like a really good idea, not just because it happens to be what I'm working on these days, but also because it has some kind of peculiar qualities as engine subsystems go, right? It's kind of a newcomer to game engines. You could argue, I suppose, that Doom and Quake had physics in the sense that there were literally rules about how the physical objects interacted, but those rules were they didn't because they were all static. So it would be hard to really draw a very close analogy between those and the kind of rigid body simulations we're using these days, at least without giggling. And furthermore, physics is inherently more challenging than some other engine subsystems in certain ways, which makes the development challenges kind of more interesting. For example, a lot of engine subsystems are really output only, like graphics and sound. You take your parcel of data and you throw it over the wall and you're like, I don't care, draw it on the screen, play it through the speakers, I don't need to hear anything back. Whereas physics is super in-out. You get, you know, almost as much data back on a frame-by-frame basis that you use for really important things as you put into it. Whoops. I'm getting ahead of myself. Furthermore, physics engines are still really tweaky and unpredictable. Like with graphics, when you give it a triangle, and with sound, when you hand it a waveform, you can be pretty certain that that triangle is going to show up on the screen and the sound's going to come out of the speakers. But with physics, it's still relatively trivial to get things like shove an object out of the world or get things to go unstable and things to blow up or lots of energy to come into the system in ways where they really shouldn't. So even if you manage to wrangle all that stuff, which is certainly a doable problem as we've seen in some recent shipping games, physics's contribution to your game is still relatively unexplored. Like, what do you do with physics? You know, so that presents some really interesting design challenges. All of these things, as a lead, you kind of have to deal with. So now to foist off some kind of random theory, I classify game engine subsystems in one of two categories. You have platform subsystems and you have world sim subsystems. Platform subsystems are things like networking and file.io, where they are, even at the theoretical level, very aware of the hardware that they're running on, and they're kind of the foundation that bridges from that hardware to basically the petri dish that is your little virtual world simulation. World simulation subsystems, at the implementation level, are aware of the hardware because they're making D3D calls and stuff like that. But at the theoretical level, they're really just metaphysics. Like, they are running your world simulation, and they aren't, you know, specific to the platform. And as world simulation systems, for example, physics, gain in complexity, the platform systems that feed them, like networking and file.io, obviously scale in complexity because, like, now you have to load physics halls and you've got to transfer, you know, more rigid body state over the network and stuff like that. But furthermore, the other world simulation systems really scale pretty dramatically to maintain consistency. So I'll go into more detail later, of course, but just in general, you know, as physics becomes more complex, it dictates additional complexity in the other subsystems. Because generally speaking, you want your world simulation to be consistent and with as few rough edges as possible. So you have this kind of sympathetic complexity that has to spread to the other subsystems as any one simulation subsystem becomes more complex. So onward, the format from here on out is I'm just going to do a slide per kind of high-level issue that you run into when you're doing development work with physics. And when I was trying to sort them, I came up with this kind of three space that they fit into, which hopefully will be useful to you guys too, where there's three axes to each issue. The first is, to what extent is this issue really purely technical? You know, to what extent does it dictate coding tasks, increase your debugging load, just a raw engineering effort? The second one is, to what extent does the issue increase or generally make more complex the communications between your programmers? You know, your physics programmer really has to talk to your engine provider's programmers a lot here because of this, or to your graphics programmer or something like that. And then on a related note, the third axis is, to what extent does this issue affect how your programmers have to communicate with your design team, you know, and increase that load? So that said, let's go ahead and survey some issues. So you'll notice on the upper right, I've put a little really loose unitless graph for each issue that says, you know, where I think it kind of falls on each of those three axes. I'm starting with engine evaluation, mostly because it's chronologically the first thing you're going to run into. The future ones I've kind of sorted, so the pure tech ones are first, and then we get into programmer-to-programmer communication issues, and at the end, it's mostly the design considerations. So starting with engine evaluation, I'm kind of considering it, you know, obviously very heavily technical, because there's a lot of code evaluation you have to do. And to some extent, you have to consider how the engine that you license will cause your programmers to interface. That's the middle bar. It's not that big. But there's also a really substantial component of engine evaluation that has to do with design, right? Like, you have to take your designer's needs into consideration, obviously, first and foremost, when you're evaluating the engine. So this also actually goes really well with Casey's talk earlier, because he talked about all sorts of code reuse and evaluating that. So, and as I point out on the slide, I mean, one slide is not going to do engine evaluation a whole lot of justice, but to kind of hit the top points, hopefully everyone here already knows this because we all wisely chose to show up at this elite gathering, but the first thing I do whenever I'm evaluating any code is send email to every friend I have who might have used anything even remotely similar and say, like, how much did this suck? And they write back and they're like, it didn't suck too bad, or like, it really sucked, don't use it, or something. So that's the first step that I recommend that I do when I'm evaluating stuff like this. Beyond that, you know, you have to get your design requirements really solid in order to know what you're looking for. And I don't mean like, hey, designers, tell me exactly what you're going to need and you can't change it later. But more to the point, you know, what do you think you're going to need and how firmly do you know? Like, oh, well, we're making CrateStacker 3000. So it's really important that our physics engine handle very deep piles of boxes. And also, we think we'd like ragdolls. We're not really sure what for, but, you know, if it supports them really well, we'll use it. Well, that tells you, obviously, like, hey, if it has ragdolls, good, but don't make that a make or break feature. But obviously, if things don't go to sleep appropriately or when you stack a lot of boxes, they explode, that would be a red flag. The next is stuff that Casey really covered in pretty good detail, just in terms of how your code is actually going to work with that code. you know, evaluate how you would get data to the physics engine. You know, do you have to duplicate your world wrap? As far as I know, in just about every licensable engine currently, you do, which is kind of unfortunate. But you know, you have to hand physics, for the most part, a copy of the data, and you know, what formats does it use, and how transparent is it, that kind of stuff. From a code point of view, you want to be really aware of what domain you want the engine to serve. You know, like there are some companies out there that I know have licensed physics engines for nothing but fast ray casting because they're on a tight schedule. And conversely, there's plenty of companies that just licensed it for pure simulation and didn't really use much query functionality. So, you know, you want to know what you're looking for and keep that in mind. Beyond that, you know, like I said, I'm not going to cover that in full scope, but, you know, evaluate every parameter about it that you think you care about. And as a lead, obviously, it's your job to manage this whole process. Because if you don't do it, no one else will. Okay, so next, going into kind of the pure tech ones, asynchronicity. We kind of talked about a lot of higher level, not physics specific asynchronicity with the Intel guys last night. At IonStorm on Deus Ex 2 and Thief 3, physics was the second most millisecond hungry subsystem after graphics. And I think AI was like a really close third, but I'm pretty sure physics was in second place. So just, if you're working on platforms that have multiple processors or fast multi-thread stuff, from a performance point of view, it's a really obvious choice to parallelize physics and graphics. But from an implementation point of view, it's not actually that obvious a choice because it's really hard. Like I said, you know, physics is a really input-output system instead of output-only. And so you need to really consider things like, you know, at what latency is tolerable for getting data back? You know, do I need, on the one extreme, you know, to get a callback every time a collision occurs and be able to evaluate, you know, whether or not, tell the physics engine in that moment whether or not to handle that or not? Or on the other extreme, you know, can I get some data back a couple frames later about guys that got hit and use that to inflict damage? And it's probably somewhere in between. But, you know, you need to be aware of what performance concessions you're willing to make to get that kind of, you know, latency versus, or latency and bandwidth you can tolerate. So next one is networking. To clarify, I've never worked on a multiplayer game, so I don't have any firsthand experience with this, but I talked to a handful of people who have, Chris on Halo 2 and stuff like that, and it sounds like generally people do, you know, your authoritative physics simulation on your server, and you do a predictive one on your client side, and you broadcast corrective packets as you go. So that's not a huge load on networking, but what you do with that data can be really tricky, and it's something you really need to think about pretty heavily. When you get a corrective packet as the client, you know, what do you do with that? Well, if the object has only diverged a little bit, maybe you totally ignore it. If it's diverged a lot, you have to do something. Common solutions seem to just be direct warping, especially if you're not looking at it. Or you can warp the physics representation and lerp the graphical one over a short period of time. All of these things are in use. But you also have to be aware that when you do this, you're kind of making all of your objects vaguely kinematic, right? By kinematic, I mean not physically driven. You know, you are moving them in a way where their movement is not well differentiable, and that causes problems. That's an issue on a slide later. Next one is memory usage. Many licensable physics engines are not theoretically well-bounded in their memory usage. I do not know of any licensable physics engine where you give it an N megabyte chunk of memory, and it says, I will never use more memory than this, I will never do allocations, I will degrade quality if I need to, which is really too bad, especially if you're developing on consoles. For the most part, you know, you talk to people and it's like, well, you know, in most cases it doesn't really spike or anything like that. But at IonStorm, a good example was, since we have this crazy open-ended stuff and give the player all this agency, you could round up all of the ragdolls from a level and throw them into a pit and like jump on them, and the memory would just start soaring. And so we tried to get our designers to do things, so maybe it was really hard. You had to like carry them for like 20 minutes so you kind of get what you deserve. But at the same time, we'll fail TCR if we crash. So we had these hideous, hideous hacks. First we'd start degrading quality, ragdolls wouldn't self-collide. Then ragdolls wouldn't collide with each other. Then we'd just start turning the quality down until it was like going to be unacceptable. And then, and this is of personal interest to me because I wrote the sound engine that got stolen from, physics would start stealing memory from other subsystems. So anyone who's ever written a sound engine, you get really used to this. You just kind of get really dejected when they keep taking your resources until by the end of development you have like a nanosecond and 250K. But it actually got to the point where if physics spiked enough, my sound engine would have to warm reboot and use half the memory, and so it would go from 2 megs down to a minimum of 250K of memory, which is obviously really hideous, but it's better than crashing. So this can be a really big issue, and it's really something to think about. And I have a chip on my shoulder about it. Okay, so the next one, as you can see with the little bar graph over there, we're getting more towards communication issues. This one is on the implementation and scheduling risk of features that you're going to add that sit on top of the physics engine. Because a lot of times, if you don't do a full prototype, it's easy to look at the API and kind of think that it supports everything you need, and then it's missing some subtle thing and you can't do it at all. And even if it does have all the support you need, and it's like, oh, this will be perfect, all we'll do is constrain a 30 by 30 grid of bodies together with these really flimsy constraints. What could possibly go wrong? And then, like, it explodes and everything goes everywhere. So it's really important. Obviously, this is still really heavily tech because it's important to prototype this from code. It's also really important that the programmer-programmer communication is up there because it's important that your physics programmer be really in touch with the engine providers and saying, hey, we're thinking of doing this. Has anyone else done this? You know, do you know if it worked? Do you have any suggestions if it didn't? And programmer-designer communication is important because, hey, if it's not going to work, you know, your designers can often come up with workarounds, or they need to be prepared for the case where it's just not going to happen. And in the worst cases, it falls onto this next slide, which is the risk and scheduling perils of expecting new features from your engine provider. So this is super important to have a really good relationship with your engine provider and be really clear with them about the kinds of things you expect from them and think that you're going to need that they don't have. And to know from their point of view what their attitude about that is. You know, oh, yeah, we're totally willing to work with you guys and add features for stuff, or, you know, no, we're not willing to add anything that isn't totally orthogonal that everyone else in the world can't use. You also need to be aware that, you know, when your needs don't align, you know, you might get in arguments. You know, you're a physics programmer and they have to have a really good relationship to kind of work through the issues. And again, it's important to plan for workarounds and have this stuff really, really nailed down, the things you're going to expect from them and what you're going to do if you can't get it, and let your designers know of the risk of that as it's going on. Okay. Interactions with other engine systems. Now we're really getting to the programmer-programmer intercommunication. I kind of touched on this stuff before. I'll just go over a couple issues. And these aren't all the systems, obviously, that physics interacts with, but these are the big three that I kind of thought of when I was writing it up. It's important to really consider how the data that you get back from physics is going to be rendered by your other world sim systems. So for graphics, for example, you know, everyone uses lower polygon hulls for high detail geometry, and so sometimes when they're resting on things, you know, they hover, they interpenetrate a little because the representations don't match. At IonStorm, we had the stencil shadow engine, which looked really nice because you got these really geometrically accurate shadows, but when things were hovering or interpenetrating, it was painfully, painfully obvious, like, that thing's freaking floating on the table. And everyone complained, and so you've got to, you know, be prepared to do these little hacks and, you know, tweak things to make sure and, you know, plan to spend some time on that. Raycasting's another one. You know, if you want to be able to, if you're going to use your physics raycasting engine and you want to have the fine control to be able to shoot through banisters and stuff like that, obviously, it's going to hit the physics hull, so maybe you need to raycast against the graphics hulls, and that's really slow. So things to keep in mind. From sound, actually, I gave a GDC talk on physics sound, so you can just read my slides if you care. But as far as I know, no licensable physics engine has a solution for physics sound. But you know, most of the people who've shipped games recently with rigid body physics seem to come up with about the, you know, like Halo 2 and Half-Life 2 and Deus Ex 2 and Thief 3. You know, basically, take contacts and do heuristic parsing of them, boil them down to something intuitive, and let sound designers hook up sounds for them. But you need to plan for who's going to implement this, because it's really no more sound than physics, so it's probably going to be one of those two programmers. But just be aware that it's something that has to happen, and it's not a trivial task. AI, similarly, AI is the reason there's a little tiny bit of programmer-designer communication axis here. Because, you know, the AI, you're never going to be able to have them react in the perfect human way to the space of things that the player can now do with physics, most notably like pelting allies with junk and stuff like that. And so, you know, you have to keep your designers in the loop on, you know, hey, you know, what, at IonStorm, they kind of reprimand you, but they'll never aggro and kill you because that's obnoxious. But with increased player agency, thanks to all the new stuff physics lets you do, the AIs need to kind of handle that in at least a reasonably realistic way. So the next issues are kind of drawing lines, kind of establishing responsibilities and who's responsible for what. And the line between your engine provider and your physics programmer is a really important one, and it's important to make sure that it's really crisp, and when it's not, you need to really worry. For example, the player controller, which I'll talk about as its own issue later, at IonStorm we decided we were going to really try to use the one that we licensed, and we didn't have source code or anything like that. So in theory, it really saved us a lot of coding time, but when little things went wrong, there's a huge turnaround from getting new features from your engine provider. You know, even though, I mean, to be fair, Havok really worked really well with us, and I don't want to say anything bad about them, but obviously it's going to take longer than if we had the source code and we were screwing with it ourselves. Whereas Valve for Half-Life 2 really just rolled their own, and it was heavily non-physical and stuff like that, which presumably they spent more time coding overall, but when things went wrong, they could turn it around like that. Other things, source access obviously affects the way that you interact with your engine provider. And it's not entirely clear to me that you really want it, even if you can have it, because it demands a lot of diligent self-control, especially on your part as the technical lead. Because you really don't want to change it unless you absolutely must, but it's really tempting to just go in there and screw with it when you want something new. So it's very powerful. It's a powerful tool like a table saw. You can cut off your hand. And like I said, this is something that got us in trouble a couple times at IonStorm. So be really clear on what expectations are for what your physics programmer is going to do and what your engine provider is responsible for. So the next one is the line between your physics programmer and your game programmers. And this one's a little murkier because there's a lot of stuff that's kind of a game feature, but it's really heavily physically based. At IonStorm, for instance, doors was this kind of unfortunate thing where the Deus Ex 2 team just asked the physics programmer, like, hey, can we get some doors? And he's like, I'm on it. And he came back and he's like, here you go. And it was a hinge constraint. And they expected like a dialogue with like building stuff to like make doors and place them in the world. And they're like, this isn't a door, this is a hinge. And so that kind of became a problem because we didn't communicate well enough. We weren't clear enough about who was expected to do what. And the physics programmer expected that the game programmers would just take raw physics functionality that he had made sure worked and was stable and actually make the game implementation stuff with it. And there's a lot of stuff like that, right? Like if you throw something heavy at an AI, you know, he's going to take damage. Is that a physics task or a game task? Things like that, and it's important to make sure that it's clear whose responsibility that is and you're monitoring who's doing what. Another example of kind of a conflict there was at IonStorm, one of our game programmers got tired of the poor performance of using full physical hulls for things like grenades and flinders. Flinders are like little shards of boxes that you've broken and stuff like that. So he just wrote a particle physics system using the raycast with Havok. And it was good, like it was really fast and it worked well. But like, hey, now there's this new system that needs maintenance and the physics programmer didn't even know where the code was and stuff like that. So again, not a huge problem, but like as a lead, it's really important to be sure that you know who's working on what and who's going to be, you know, what tasks are going to happen that are going to create extra work in the future. And again, this is something to worry about if it's not really clear who's responsible for what. Okay, now we're towards the end because this is all programmer designer stuff. Kinematic objects. Like I said, kinematic objects are objects that are not driven by the simulation. They're driven by a motion controller that's using some game logic, right? Like, you know, whatever, elevators are the example I'll use from IonStorm, but anything that's kind of like otherwise immobile that's moving around on a path or something like that. And it's pretty clear, you know, like, hey, we want to be able to control an object and we want to be able to dictate where it ends up at a certain time. And like, that seems really obvious. But when you actually work out the details, it gets really tricky. You know, again, in an example of probably communication that could have been a lot better, we asked the DX2 team asked the physics programmer at IonStorm for elevators. And they were like, just make them like Thief elevators. Thief 1 and Thief 2, those are the elevators we want. And he's like, you want them motorized and physical? And they're like, no, make them kinematic. We don't want you to be able to obstruct them with pipes or things like that. So he went off and then he kept coming back with all these questions like, well, what if something's blocking them? We're going to just crush it, just blow it up. And he's like, okay, and then he left and he came back. And he's like, what if it's a really game critical object and how do I know that? Like there's a data cube that you have to read that has a code. And they're like, oh, well, you know, obviously don't crush that. And so so it turned into this huge thing, and the physics programmer got really annoyed because he's like, you don't know what you want, and you're, you know, telling me this stuff, and I have to keep coming back. And I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing that there was a lot of, like, programmer-designer interaction, but it's something to realize and not underestimate up front, especially with tasks like kinematic objects. You know, expect that that's going to take a lot of that kind of back and forth so people don't get frustrated when they feel like they're not making progress, and it's not going to be a really fast task. You aren't going to be able to come up with just total blanket rules and some really turnkey solution for it. You're going to have stuff for the designers to special case and tweak, like, this is kinematic, but it can be stopped by things that weigh this much, or something like that. So yes. Perhaps even more complicated than kinematic objects are the player controller, which is definitely, in my experience anyway, one of the most time-intensive parts of using a physics engine. It wants to feel really responsive to the player, so it's hard to make it totally physically driven, but at the same time, it wants to play nice with physical objects in the world, and in most cases, you probably want the player to have certain agency, like be able to bump into a table, and if they push hard enough, knock it over. But that stuff's really subtle and tweaky and hard to get right. Basically, every major physics engine has a player controller, but as far as I'm concerned, they're usually mostly like a sample that you run off of, because I don't know anyone who's just shipped with just the vanilla player controller from their engine. Like, you'll probably want some real custom stuff. Like, oh, we want you to be able to, you know, do log rolling. So we're going to be able to stand on a log and run, and you don't move, but the log spins, and, you know, something like that. Again, you know, be aware what your constraints are. As an issue, I put your physics programmer in here, because I think, not because physics programmers are bad or unruly, but because I think it's non-obvious. You know, you might think at first glance, like, hey, you want someone who just knows physics, like could write their own simulator, and I think that's really not true at all. I would rather put someone who's really charismatic and a good communicator and doesn't know the first thing about physics in charge of the physics integration. Because they're responsible for an enormous amount of communication, I think more than any other engine programmer, right? They are the technical liaison to your engine provider. They're the liaison to the other programmers and your engine team who need support. And like, since I mentioned, physics tends to be tweaky and kind of unreliable a lot of the time when you're doing really complex stuff. You know, they need to be able to explain that and work with people to work it out. Similarly, they need to work with the designers to provide them tools, and the designers will get frustrated when things don't work quite the right way. Stuff like that. And so, also because of the kind of instability and tweakiness problems a lot of the time, they need to be really proactive when things are going wrong, and they need to, you know, feel really comfortable bringing problems up and stuff like that. I mean, you know, like, you can get yourself in a lot of trouble if you hire someone who has a freaking PhD in physics, but is otherwise this, like, curmudgeonly misanthrope, you're screwed. So, Chris.
I'm curious if I guess it's completely focused on the slide questions.
Sure, that's fine.
I'm curious what Jay and Chris think about the trade off between knowledge of physics versus charismatic, good looking stuff instead.
Not curmudgeonly misanthrope.
We're
really close to the end, so how about we can pick individual issues if people remember them? So, how about I just finish like the last two? Okay, sure, go ahead.
Jay, hot dude, or really smart misanthrope?
No.
When we started kind of early, several years ago, and a lot of these things hadn't been figured out, the technology was pretty robust, but there's still a fair amount of understanding about how, you know, physics actually works in order to successfully implement a bunch of things we wanted to do. I certainly didn't
Yeah, I mean, I guess I should mention that at Ion Storm we were working on two games that were substantially different simultaneously, so we had pretty well-divided engine and game teams more than that. But yeah, I mean, if you're in a situation where your engine team and your game team are kind of one and the same, then obviously a lot of those lines would go away. Also, it would be an overstatement. It was an overstatement for me to say that I would put someone in charge of physics who had no knowledge of physics whatsoever. But yeah. I think this is actually the last one. This is kind of an issue with pretty much all game systems for everything, the do what I mean versus realism problem, where, you know, especially depending on how ivory tower your engine provider is, this may be more or less of a problem. But the idea, you know, if you've ever, and I'm not saying this is actually true, actually, like, Havoc is really not very ivory tower, so we didn't have this problem too much with them. But if you've ever written to anyone who is not a game developer and said something like, hey, we want it to work this way, and they're like, but that's not right. And you're like, no, I understand, but our designer wants it to work that way. It can become something of a problem when your designer comes to you and says, like, I want this particular thing, and left to its own devices, the simulator is not going to do it. And, you know, at the very least, if you have a really good motion controller, if you have really good support for kinematic objects and you've worked that out, oftentimes you can pretty much approximate everything they're going to want by just doing it all yourself and driving it with game logic. As long as you can get it to play nice with physics. But, you know, again, it's something to be aware of. And, you know, keeping in mind the special things designers are going to want that aren't necessarily physically accurate and how that's going to work with your engine is pretty important. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that happens a lot, especially, like, the obvious literal example is when you have two bodies with infinite mass and, you know, like, the designer wants them both to do important things that cause them to push each other or something like that. And so, yeah. And that, of course, comes down to, you know, training your designers and working with them to explain, like, why something can't be done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's not always intuitive what the equations come out to.
Yep. That's a good point. And that's it. Midway through this journey from facing that way to facing this way, it runs into something, I think this also pairs, it's interesting that this issue pairs poorly with asynchronicity in a lot of ways, because a lot of inherently contradictory situations you can at least override if you have immediate access to the data. Like, during the frame, I intercept things that are going on and I screw with it. But you know, if you're running asynchronous and you have to wait for a frame or two, you know, God help you, to get your data back and muck with it, well, the simulator's already gone ahead with it for a little while. So in some cases, when it boils down to something that you could intercept and fix up manually at the time, that makes the asynchronicity problem even harder. So. Well, I don't actually have to say anything for my final slide. That's about it. You can read it. I have no idea how long that took. Do I have any time for questions?
We got plenty of time for questions, actually.
Sweet.
Not that we haven't been doing them for a few minutes already, but questions? Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I was wondering, basically, how many people use a actually physically controlled character versus something which, you know, tried to make the player, like, so let me phrase it this way. In Halo 2, we made that character actually be completely physical in the sense that, you know, he moves by using just accelerations so that, you know, when things hit him and all that, it worked out good, but it has problems because then, of course, the player doesn't get to control his character exactly where he wanted to go. But I know a lot of people went the other direction, and that's certainly the direction that Havoc's going with their built-in player controller. And so I was wondering, you know, where in the spectrum people are.
All right, let's do that as a poll. So there's two possibilities, right? One of the possibilities is to move your player around, you actually apply physics forces to him and you try to pre-compute the forces. Well, that's going to be option three. Like, I don't do physics, right? So option one is you apply physics forces to the guy to try and get him to go the right speed or whatever. Option two is you move him just in code and then you... whenever he tries to interact with the physics engine, you kind of hack it, right? And option three is, I don't do this physics stuff. Yeah, that's what I said. Well, really, it applies to any game. It's more critical in first-person games because in first-person games, you know, traditionally you care a whole lot about, like, the movement quality, but it also does apply to things like third-person games. I mean, I made a 2D game earlier this year where I consciously made that decision between one and another. So who moves their guy actually physically with forces or whatnot? Wow.
But highly constrained.
Sure, but you actually do it like the... quote, right way for living in a simulator, right?
Yeah.
Capital R, right way, if your player is accurately modeled as a rectangular parallel pipe.
Yeah. Okay, so who, like, moves their guy just in code like you would in games before physics engines came on the scene, and then the interaction with the physics engine you just somehow also handle through, like, a hack layer kind of thing? Yeah. Okay. So that's kind of close. So Jay, wouldn't you describe actually what you do as more of like a hybrid sort of thing, or? Yeah. Yeah. So who does neither? Like, you're just not
in the physics action at all. Okay, so that's about 9 also.
I don't want to spawn another survey, but I think it would be, I would speculate that people are more easily able to physically simulate the character if you're on a console, because you have a little more, you know, if you're using a thumbstick. Like, I don't know if you guys are planning to do Halo 2 PC, but it'd be really interesting to see if you could get away with doing a purely physical character with a mouse and keyboard, because I think you'd really know, like, I press W and it's like, you know, like, it doesn't feel as responsive. Yeah.
Well, since you're a box, right, that's a problem. But if you were, an infinite rotational inertia cylinder, then it wouldn't necessarily matter because you just, Yeah. Right.
In addition to these options, which is you do it physically, you do it in set position, or you do something which is some kind of mesh of the two. What I've been looking at and trying to get working, and I'm not saying I have a full solution for this, is a kind of a physics engine, or at least a subsystem that can tolerate set position. Then, on the basis of that, compute from using a delta, like in implicit integration schemes that we were looking at the start, you can infer the displacement and so forth, change that into a physical quantity, put that back into your physical state for your physical entity, and then feed that back to the physics system, which allows you to basically, you control it automatically, but you keep it upgraded, up to date with the physics system.
Yeah, that's kind of falls into option two. I mean, my question about that is, what do you do about the stuff that Jay was talking about? Like, when you poke values directly into the physics like that, you end up with very high momenta, right? Yeah, I would classify what he said as the second. Yeah, but I mean, there's various different ways to do it.
The way, I mean, you have to do option two, right? Say, I want to be here, and you solve for the physics that will bring the physics proxy there.
Well, that's kind of option one, though, right?
No,
There's two ways to do kind of the same thing that I would categorize as one or the other. One is like, okay, they both start with, I'm going to take the keyboard input, figure out what my like hard-coded player speed is, just, add a vector based on that, and then that's where the player wants to be, kind of a thing, right? And then what do you do with that? Like, the physical thing would be, I'm not actually going to move the guy's position there, but I'm going to use that to compute forces that put him there, and then I'm going to give those forces to the physics engine and just hope that they put him there, but I'm not overriding physics at all. I'm just generating a control force based on the keyboard input, right?
I think it's like...
And this one is, I'm actually going to move him and then retroactively maybe set the velocity on the guy to like kind of, or the momentum and things to kind of make it work out, right?
Well, that's what he was describing. That extracting the momentum out of the previous couple of frames maybe.
You mean for the player?
On the player. Like, it seems like everyone is using infinite angular momentum.
Yeah, okay. Does anyone use, like, finite angular momentum on the player generated by the physics engine at all? One. Okay. That makes a lot of sense.
I say go for it. The player rotates in the cockpit?
All right. Further questions on...
While you're on this topic, several people have asked, how many people are currently using, just go through, like, Havoc, their own...
Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah, I'd say have shipped a product with.
Hey, Jeff, do you want to write this down? Because we've got photo records of those other ones.
Okay.
So we're gonna put all these on the website along with the slides and stuff, to the extent that... They're all successfully recorded.
They're highly scientifically accurate.
No, I wouldn't erase these. That's why I was just asking. I mean, I'll do it.
Yeah. I'm just trying to keep you from.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, what are the options? We got Havoc, Novadex, karma, ODE, Mekon. What are some other physics engines?
Grinderware.
Custom, yes. Oh, is it? I don't use those, so okay. Any that we're missing that anyone's using? Okay, so who? You know, we're all kind of casual here. Like, if you plan to ship the game and it's going pretty good, that counts too. You know,
because
because we all know that once it looks like it's going pretty good, it's going to ship and be fine, right? So who uses Havoc right now?
Wow.
Okay, like.
I have used Havoc, but now I work for their competitor.
Yeah. Okay, Novadex. Nobody uses Novadex in this whole room. Well, we'll get there. Okay, Karma. One. Okay, three. Wow. Zero. ODE. Okay. Yeah. Mekon. And Custom. Wow.
Wow.
You mean it's good, though?
Well, we'll get to that. Okay, so now, I'm not going to break this down by engine because that'll take way too long and whatever. But so, of you guys who replied to this previous poll, how many of you are satisfied with the engine and how it's revving and will use the same one next time? Raise your hand if that's true. Like, for sure. Well, then you would say no. So, like, satisfied is like 15. And then so who's unsatisfied and is going to try something different next game?
Well, do my own.
Three. Okay.
No, I'm going from custom to custom, but I'm just going to do it better. not me.
Okay. So this is kind of interesting because one thing that we hear about physics engines all the time is that they're unstable and they blow up and their performance is bad, but at the same time, all those people who are complaining are also okay with what they've got somehow, or I don't know. I mean, that's kind of interesting. Yeah, well, you know, that's a good point.
I think, like, the expectation level is kind of like people gripe because we're programmers and that's what we do, but, you know, the expectation level is also at the point where it's like, well, there's not, like, some physics engine that never fails and you can't get it to break.
Okay,
so
yeah. The modulator on that is actually the question and the follow-up question. How many people have physics in their game that actually affects gameplay?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Okay, so, right, so gameplay-oriented physics as opposed to special effects physics, right? So gameplay. Okay. 16. Wow.
Oh.
Who uses physics just for special effects? Like things, like it's a one-way thing, like the ponytail or the explosion debris kind of stuff. Part, yeah. Do I count you guys for a half each or something? Like, okay, so that's one. That's kind of interesting because a couple years ago this would have been totally different. Right? I mean, it was almost the other way around, so that's cool. Which would seem to imply that engines are good enough now to actually do gameplay with.
It seems like people are migrating maybe because more would take a lot more would be in the custom.
Yeah. Okay. Further questions, issues? Anyone want to make a statement?
Like,
okay, so in other words, they get by with a lighter level of physics.
Yeah.
There's like four or five. Yeah. Hmm? Yeah, I mean, yeah. Yeah. John.
I would just add, you know, we talked about the maturity of the engine. Planet side's a couple of years old, and we used a Karma, but we had to do all of our broad phase and narrow phase ourselves to get it even run. Nowadays, it's feasible for you to take the physics engine and hand it your entire universe and say, go solve. And that's a major evolution in maturity.
Yeah. I've done what?
Multi-paraphysics.
Yeah, okay. This is an interesting one. So who in this room has done multiplayer physics where, you know, the players interact in a world, and so the question, can the physics affect the players?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, so where the world physics can impart, you know, impulses on the players and stuff. A lot, actually. More than I would have expected. Oh yeah, yeah. Okay, not computed on like the same CPU and yeah.
Like who had to deal with that networking problem?
Well, let me write down the previous number. Okay, so not so 4, 5, 6.
I don't think. Yeah.
Still more than I would have expected. Like.
I think people missed that question because the Bungie guys didn't raise their hands, and they certainly have. Like
where
multi-CPU client server.
Okay. It can be client server, right, with the server doing authoritative physics, but it's just to differentiate between console style like split screen where there's just one simulation running, right? So I'll add one for the Bungie guys. So that's a lot. You know, that's yeah. I would not have guessed 9. So that's cool. Right, but I mean, you kind of do some stuff on the client to smooth it out, right? But I mean, well, that it still qualifies because no, seriously, like the differentiation was between like one entity doing physics, all the physics and the rendering versus multiple ones, you know? Because there's just a lot of issues, like, hey, how do you interpolate without, you know? Yeah. Yeah. Well, you guys, I know from play. Let me just ask you this: like for Counter-Strike, it seems like your update rate for objects is just really high. Like I was trying to figure out, you know, is the client running a local simulation or are you just interpolating and stuff? And I play a lot of Counter-Strike, right? So I know what it looks like when people are doing goofy stuff, like they knock over the barrels when I'm trying to run through the door and stuff. And it seems like pretty accurate, right? So, like, how fast do you shove those down the pipe?
So, the Counter-Strike right now, most of the objects are totally server-side. So, players interact with them on the server, and they get updates. Our updates, they're pretty regular. It depends on your connection. It's not a absolute thing, right? So, you get different updates if you have a lower rate connection. Actually, I don't know off the top of my head, but, yeah, something like that. For broadband, certainly. 10,000 bytes per second, right? So that's the max. It'll throttle you after that. But so the defaults is there's a bunch of the, like the barrels and things like that that, you know, deflect gunfire and all that are on the server. And then there are a bunch of other objects as junk that are on the client, and those are instant on the client. And they're in different places on every client. So they don't actually block gunshots from hitting you. But if someone else shoots their gun and it'll hit one of those client-side objects, right?
But so you just, for something like a barrel, you just rely on the fact that the data is small enough that you can send it a lot when it's getting knocked around.
Yeah, and also you know, we don't have the tight coupling between the player movement and the barrels. In Counter-Strike, it has like kind of a repellent force. So at some point it'll get a more predictive physics simulator, I would expect. But right now it doesn't do that. And then in Half-Life 2 Deathmatch, we actually run the physics server side and with all the players and everything, so you can stand on stuff and pick stuff up and carry it around with the gravity gun and all that. But and then the gravity gun, that's a kind of the weak answer to this, but in Half-Life 2 Deathmatch, we actually have a predicted physical simulation for the gravity gun on the client, but that's it. You know, we don't have a full range. You can start stuff simulating on the client, and when the server starts simulating it, it'll go and reconcile those two simulations and figure out how to make the client one resemble the authoritative server one, other than the gravity gun, right?
Further comments, questions?
I'm curious to know if anyone has their own, like, short list, really big issues they ran into that I didn't have in my slides. Like, anything where you're like, oh, my God, this was a gigantic problem, and he didn't even touch on it.
So, breaking stuff and callbacks, right? You throw a rock at the window, you want the window to break, but you don't, you know, you want the rock to pass through the window. Or even worse, you drive a vehicle into a window, and you need the window to break.
Yeah.
And how that's in your API. This is an example of a kind of set of things where the game defines the behavior that this thing should break, so you can make it not glass or, you know, something else, or a kinematic object that needs to become dynamic because it collided with a vehicle, let's say, if that makes it have the problem for your system and the glass window didn't. So currently, at least as I understand it, with the stuff I'm familiar with, you kind of have to hack that. You know, you get a collision resolution when the collision happens, even if the game wants to decide at that point that it doesn't want one. Mm-hmm. So it's the kind of thing that the decoupling between physics and the game is going to get more difficult, because there are a bunch of examples of things like that that are, you know, I spend a lot of time working with stuff like that, if we're talking just about technical things. But
yeah, that's a good point. I wonder if we're going to end up with, like, a substantial amount of coding work being done on, like, especially if we go to something more asynchronous where, like, you spend a lot of time undoing things and backing objects up to, you know, re-predict, you know, kind of forward where they would have been if the window had broken correctly or something.
I have a laundry list of them. Off the top of my head, LOD, LOD, collision LOD is one of my biggest pet peeves, that objects should have different collision representations. Oftentimes it's based on game logic. You know, if you're carrying a certain spell, it doesn't collide with the same thing under other conditions. Scale, none of the APIs I'm aware of yet support scale, instant scale, and that's a problem. Also multiple collision representations for ray casting, where, you know, the physics collides with one thing, but when you're doing ray casting, you want to ray cast against a much more detailed representation. And the APIs tend to have this sort of flat, here's my world. Well, my world's more complicated than that, and it's difficult to represent sort of the richness that you need.
Well, that's kind of, I kind of mentioned, like, maybe you have to ray cast. I mean, like, at IonStorm, we ran into some problems where we needed things. We eventually just didn't even ship with decals because you have to raycast against your graphics model so much. And, like, we got John to write us this graphics raycaster, but, like, it takes a long time because you're locking and unlocking a bunch of stuff. So I think LOD is also kind of particular to the... It really exacerbated by your game because, like, you can... The player avatar can be a gigantic flying ship or, like, a little guy or...
Careful.
Or we're moving from large game levels to vehicle-based combat. So my problems may not be that it's the first rough that everybody's dealing with.
Yeah.
Pursuant to your last question, like, what big problems people have seen, I'm actually, this is like the inverse of that, like, I'm actually really surprised that stability has not been a problem for people trying to integrate physics into gameplay. Like, that's, I mean, I don't know if anyone has any anecdotes on that front. It's like it actually was more of a problem than everyone's implying, or if it really just, like, they just work good enough now.
Yeah, just to answer your question, one of the issues we had when we started doing that is game designers looking at it and saying, you know, I call it the superhuman effect. They kind of look at the object or the hero or character falling, and he's saying, he's not falling fast enough. So you're saying, well, you know, that's what the simulation is. Well, he's got to fall faster. So you wind up applying like 3G acceleration going down on the object, and that creates all sorts of like side effects of interacting with the rest of the world.
We have time for one last one, and Jay's bugging me. So
I just wanted to say something about that. I did an experiment around the office where I had people look at physics objects tumbling or falling, and It turned out that FOV had to do with the perceived speed of gravity, and that at the wide FOVs we usually run, like if you run 90-degree FOV, things don't, they look slow. They look floaty and too large. And I don't know, I don't have like any sort of scientific data other than I noticed it while I was zoomed in on some objects, and so I rounded up a bunch of people around the office, said, look at it, look at this, now look at this. And, you know, at like 45, 50-degree FOV, things looked right. And at 90, things looked, you know, floaty. And so, well, actually, we ended up reducing our FOV a little bit, but mostly for the characters in the scenes. Not, you know, there's some distortion on them that we wanted to kind of minimize. But
so what's your FOV?
FOV is 75 in Half-Life 2. But we also exaggerate gravity, like you're saying. As a tuning, but it seems related to FOV, and I don't know, I haven't read a paper on that explains it, but.
I'll just add one more thing that made me think of that I probably would have put in my slides if I thought of it beforehand, which is getting all your masses and scales and stuff like that, right? I guess I'd compare it to kind of the gamma problem where, like, if you have to be really religious about having all of your artist monitors, like, completely correctly calibrated and have all your art totally correct, you know, and gamma correctness through your entire pipe, because if any one thing is wrong, it's all like subtly wrong. And we had problems for a long time. We're like, well, the gun's like a little bigger than it really would have been. And so they compensated by setting the mass to this unrealistic, like this wildly unrealistic number, but it still looked like it behaved right. And there were enough little things that were all subtly wrong. And they, what does Jim Blinn call it? Making an equal number of sign errors. Like they'd keep compensating back and forth. And it took a lot of rigor to go through and really clean that stuff up so that it all looked right.
All right. Thanks, Brian.